I don't think I could sleep if I'm kicking out grandma in order to make an extra $200 a month or whatever. Like, maybe $500. No, I'm just kidding.
Anson, dude, are you trying to absolutely shit on me with your setup, dude? You have the most beautiful podcast setup I've ever seen.
Oh, man. That's a huge compliment.
Dude, did you work on this? Like, how long did this take?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the year was 2020 and we were all bored out of our minds. And so, you know, kind of renovating my office, and my wife and I just kind of came up with, you know, color scheme. And obviously I wanted a neon sign, which I see you're a fan of. And yeah, just have some fun stuff back there that I like, and, you know, good times.
Where did the artistic touch come from? Was that in you, or did you do Pinterest or your wife?
Well, it was both of us. I have a drawing of it. Like, we kind of like laid it out, and then we just found pieces that we liked that kind of went in there. Like, I want more plants because I do like having green in my office. But yeah, we kind of planned it out and then just went from there. So, yeah.
Yo, I'll be honest, Anson. I'm listen, because we're friends, like, I will believe you, but that's hard to believe because it is so difficult to get stuff to look good. So
that's for
y'all just to like do it on a whim, yo, maybe this is like your hidden talent, man. You should
maybe
be interior designer.
You know, I am unashamed to say that I have a Pinterest account, and I really like Pinterest. Like, I don't know how many guys, you know, will admit that, but I actually love my Pinterest account.
What do you go on there for? Like, what kind of stuff are you looking for?
So, like, my wife and I will share, like, house ideas for interior decoration of, like, because we're going to build our own house here in the next couple of years. And so, you know, whether it's exteriors or interiors, we're planning on making, like a speakeasy setup in the basement. You know, like, just things that we both like. We share like ideas on investment interior decoration as well for flips, and you know, kind of hopping on trends but not too trendy, and seeing how we can bring down, you know, $1 million ideas into like a $400,000 house. So like little touches and details that we both, you know, catch our eye. And so, yeah, we share, I think we're on like 2 or 3 boards that we share. And then my own personal board, I just have like cool watches that I like, and aesthetics, and, you know, landscapes, and, you know, artsy stuff.
Yo, Anson, I'll be honest. You just offended me again. Oh, my God. Oh, no. So you're putting a speakeasy, a.k.a. you actually have friends, which I don't, but so you actually have friends. Like, what's your idea for the speakeasy? Because I think I've seen some cool ones online, and yeah. I'm just like, holy shit, like, how do you do this?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I have enough friends to fill up a speakeasy. It would probably be like a smaller bar, but then some like just fun areas to kind of hang out in, and maybe even shoot video and stuff in, you know, could be a nice like little set with a leather couch and, you know, nice decorations and stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's like, for us, if we're going to build a house, right, it's going to be, you know, we're in our mid 40s, so it's going to be like the house will probably just be in forever, you know. And so if it's going to be that, and we're building it from the ground up, might as well have stuff that we really want and like, you know. And you know, we've lived in several houses over the years, and there's always things that you do and don't like. And so we're just ironing out all those processes of like, we do like this, we don't like these things. And, you know, like, why not have like, because a studio and a speakeasy in your basement, unless my son, you know, stays with us through college or past college and then wants his own space to live in the basement. We have a plan for that too. So
doesn't that scare the absolute crap out of you to think like, okay, this is the house I'm going to die in? Isn't that a scary thought?
I mean, I'm a bit of a, like, just a realist, you know, like that's just the cold reality of life, you know. Why sugarcoat it? You know, that, and I want it to be a ranch so that we'll have, you know, we won't have to go up and down the stairs in our, you know, unless something happens and we decide to move, or we, you know, we're kind of embedded in our community here in Colorado. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you can't sugarcoat it, I guess. Just gotta lean into it a bit.
I just have a lot of friends that I don't know why, maybe it's a trend or something like that, but yeah. Whenever they start to think about, like, for example, I've had a couple people turn 40, 45, and they're like, you know what? I think I've lived more time on Earth than I will in the future. You know what I'm saying? And that just freaks them out. But you've overcome that.
No. I mean, my birthday was just a couple weeks ago.
And happy birthday.
Thank you. I did just turn 45. So, which is insanity to say, like, I still feel like I'm like 25 and like, I'm nowhere. You know, like we look at our parents and we think like, oh yeah, they got all that figured out. And for us, like I'm 45 now and I'm like, I don't have anything figured out. You know, my son's like 14. Like, what am I doing? Like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
That's such a good point. Oh man, I'm so glad you're saying the quiet part out loud. I feel the exact same way. I'm like 33 or something like that.
Yep.
But I still, for the most part, like honestly, 85% plus, I still think exactly how I thought when I was 15.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very immature. There's like lots of stuff. Like, I still laugh at fart jokes. All of these type of things, I'm just like, I have that same anxiety where it's like, what point does it kick in where I am an actual real adult?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it ever?
It, like, so far, no. Like, in my experience at 45, no. I don't, like, you know, my son's about to go to high school next year. You know, it's a pretty, like, serious, like, private high school. I see some of the other parents and they're probably like lawyers and doctors and like real things that feel real. And I just feel, you know, I'm like in a hoodie and jeans and I'm just like, you know, like I just feel, you know, not as grown up as they are, you know.
Are you nervous, man, about your son going to high school? Like, do you have any concerns and what's your biggest one?
Yeah, definitely concerned. I'm mainly concerned that he's just not, like, I guess from a parental standpoint, that he's just not prepared for like the difference between middle school and high school. Like, we can tell him 1,000 times, and believe me, we have, like, there, you know, everything levels up, the homework levels up, the pressure levels up, you know, now you're on this track of like 4 years and then you're out in the real world or you're off to college or like those things are scary. And I understand the anxiety, you know, on his part. Like, he doesn't want to think about those things because he's just having fun in eighth grade, you know, like with his friends and playing basketball and whatever. Now things start to get serious. And so for me, I feel like he's just not mentally prepared for that step up. And especially like he's in public school now and we're sending him to a, you know, or he got accepted to a private high school where they're a bit more academically rigorous. And like I just like you just yesterday, I got like finally like the onboarding email and stuff. And I'm just like, I'm not even ready for how insane like high school is going to be, like, let alone him. And he's just kind of like an innocent bystander about to get run over by the bus or something.
Like, yeah. So it sounds like your concerns are 100% academic. Are you worried about like the social aspects, especially switching schools? That's really freaking hard, man.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know how it is in your area. Like, he's going, he's in the same school system that my wife and I grew up in. And so, you know, it's probably like one of the best in the state. It's a great public school system. We're not putting him in private school because the public school system doesn't work or sucks. Like, we're both products of it. But we have like three or four middle schools that are pretty big and they all feed into like a high school. And so his class size will be like 1,000, you know, for a freshman class. So his graduating class is probably like roughly 1,000. And so your friend group gets diluted anyways. Like, when I, you know, my friends in eighth grade weren't my friends in 10th grade. Like, by the time, you know, things weeded out and you have a whole year of interacting with new people. So we're not too worried about that. The nice thing about his new high school is that everybody's in that situation. because it's just a high, it's like obviously just a high school. They come from like 60 different high, you know, middle schools, and there's only 220 freshmen. So, and they're all boys. So there's a boys division and a girls division. And so he'll get thrown in to kind of a brotherhood of like, they do a really good job of like making sure everybody's involved and everybody's like up to speed and ready to go. But also like, we're going to do all these things socially so that, you know, the freshman class can gel. And I mean, like one of the reasons that he's going there is I have three or four friends who went there, and I've probably met like a dozen other people who have gone to this high school, and there has been no complaints about anything from academics to friend, like lifelong friends. I can't say that. I don't talk to anybody from high school, like not one person, at least who went to my high school. So, and then also like not one of them said that they wouldn't send their kids there. They're just like, oh yeah, that's just the plan. Like I had such an amazing time and I want that for my kids. And so me coming in from the outside, I'm going, this whole process started like the end of sixth grade, where I started going, this could be a possibility, like financially, you know, academically, realistically, like getting in, but like, we should probably like look at this path at least as an option. You know, like all, I have a ton of friends who obviously want to send their kids there, and that's a high endorsement, right? Like,
yeah,
like I went through the system and I want to send my kids. I wouldn't send my son to the high school I went to, which was like the worst high school in the best, you know, district. And, you know, so like we toured, you know, the high school that he's supposed to go to in the public system. And it's just, it's massive. You know, there's 4,000 kids there.
Is it East, you know? High?
No, it. We're on the east side of Denver in a suburb, and so he'd be going to a place called Eagle Crest. So
is the private? I asked that because I walked by East High. It's beautiful. is his private school? It's a boys only school.
Yeah. Well, they have a boys division and a girls division. Just like separate buildings, but then like they intermingle on higher level classes and clubs and stuff like that. But it's been like a single sex education since like, I don't know, they've been a school for like 150 years or something like that. So,
oh my gosh, that is crazy. I could only imagine.
Yeah.
Because you're around boys all the time. And so the testosterone is building and you have like this one class with girls. And it's like, that's the one class I'm going to fail because damn it. That's the only time I get to see Maria and she's beautiful and my heart is all in for her. That has got to be crazy. So you're not worried at all about the social aspect. Maybe your son is like a social butterfly, because it seems like every parent I talk to, the number one thing is like, my child gets bullied, my child gets picked on, my child's depressed. And then like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And it's like, yeah. And they need to make good grades.
Right. Yeah. Thankfully, you know, he has a good ability to make friends kind of wherever he goes. And yeah, I think with like smaller class sizes, lower student teacher ratios, and then, you know, like, you will know like those 200 kids, like, you know, I think between all of that, I'm not, there will be a transition. I'm not like glossing it totally over, but there'll be a transition, but I'm not worried about that. I'm more worried about like the academic load, you know?
Yeah. So what do you think this private school can give your kid that the public school system couldn't?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, you know, I think that, a higher number of them go on to college. Yeah. So it's pretty much like, it's not guaranteed. They have like a 98% graduation rate that goes on to college. I think that their graduation rate is probably 100%, but 98% of them go on to college. And then there's a huge amount of merit-based scholarships that they get because it is academically rigorous. And so by the end of high school, he should be, you know, more than set up for college. Again, the same, you know, the same friends who I all talked to, they all went on to college and they all said that college was so much easier than high school was, you know, like those freshman level, sophomore level classes. they could breeze through them because they were already at that level. They didn't have to catch up to like a college level. And then I think that like just those things of like lower, you know, lower student to teacher ratios, they have like 13 kids in class, you know, versus 30 or 35, you know, so there's more attention to detail on each kid. So like there's almost no slipping through the cracks, you know, which is good. And yeah, I just think that the overall experience is just much, I don't know, just much better. Like high school is what you make of it, but you know, if we can set them up for any, like we have one kid, we got one chance at this. So if we can set them up for the most amount of success as possible, on our one go around, then we're gonna shoot for the moon on that. So
what about college? How do you counsel your kid or just maybe a kid in general on like, okay, I'm 16, I'm 17, I'm, you know, about to be a senior, it's time to pick a major. Like what advice would you give them? Because it seems like college is not as in style as it used to be.
Right. No, I fall on both sides of that fence. Like, yeah, for some kids, it's definitely not. Like one of my good friends, his son is going through trade school to go through cybersecurity IT stuff. And he goes, I can learn this now in high school and be set up for when I turn 18, you know, I can have that 4 years of getting a job where my friends are in college and they're training to get a job or whatever. And then, you know, for other kids, it's obviously important for doctors and lawyers and stuff, like they have to go to school. But I think it is a good, I think the experience probably outweighs some of the other things. Like you shouldn't go into debt.
By the way, that is so beautiful because, and this is why I actually believe your previous statement that like you do still feel like a kid because parents are like, you gotta get the degree.
Yeah.
But man, yeah, what you're saying is that social experience outside of your comfort zone, all of this stuff, it really is life changing.
Yeah, no. And I don't think you should go into debt for that experience necessarily, you know, like just for the experience, you should obviously get something else while you're there. But, you know, I'm not worried if he, you know, graduates, goes on to college, he, you know, figures things out for a year or two, you know, goes to college and maybe his first 2 years is really just kind of like figuring out adult life or figuring out, you know, campus life, or maybe he still lives at home and he goes to, you know, aviation college, you know, that's downtown here. Like there's, you know, I'm not worried about it. But that experience I think is super important, you know, like getting out and feeling a bit more independent before you're like 23, and then you're just thrown out onto the real world. Like, you know, I want him to experience some of those things before, you know, before he's done with college. And then he's just kind of thrown out and be like, now you're an adult. And like we said, you don't feel like an adult like ever. I don't know how. I should ask my dad, actually. I should just like, we don't have totally that kind of relationship, but I should just be like, Dad, when did, do you ever feel like an adult? Like he's 70, you know, six now or something. So like,
what if he said he's like, yes. And I felt like an adult at 15.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it was just a different time where like, you know, you got married and, you know, young, and you had like two or three kids by the time you're like 25 and you're like, you know, work that job, the same job for 30 years and got that pension. And, you know, it feels like we're doing things differently for the most part. And we're just trying to like figure this thing out. I don't know. It's so weird.
That is different. And I think you brought up a point that's interests me. It doesn't seem like a lot of people work the same job for 30 years. Like the whole, my work is my family, the boss comes over for dinner type stuff. It seems like that whole dynamic is extinct. Why totally, do you think that is?
Yeah, I think
have no clue.
Yeah, no. I mean, if you're in the corporate world or if you're in the company world, like the only way to move up now is to change jobs. You know, like pretty much all my friends that are still in like corporate jobs, you know, they'll have a new job every 5 years or they'll just switch their competitor and switch back. You know, I have a friend in IT who switched back and forth like three times, I think, between like VMware, which is, you know, remote computing systems company and like their competitor, and then he'll go back to VMware, and then he'll go back to like the competitor, and then he'll go back to VMware. But that's like the only way that he can get any kind of promotion or any kind of advancement, where it seems like in the past, maybe that company loyalty was really important. Like my dad worked for AT&T for his entire career, you know, like it obviously changed names, you know, as they got bought out and things, but you know, he was at the same company for like 32, 33 years, but that loyalty paid off because he could get, you know, promoted and raises, and you're obviously paying into like a pension system or you're like accruing pension, you know. Now the pension or that retirement is totally divorced from the company. You're just paying into your own 401k or whatever. And loyalty is not rewarded. So it's like, it's kind of the system now says you have to do this in order to get promoted, where the system in the past actually just promoted, you know, loyalty. And, you know, if you stick with us, we'll stick by you kind of thing, which I don't think exists for the most part anymore.
That's what I'm saying. I wonder if it's like, it's our kind of conversion to worshiping the dollar. Maybe it's like before, like maybe there was companies that were loyal, and then some other company is like, hey, listen, if we're not loyal and we're more cutthroat, we'll kick their ass. So right. That's what we do. And also, I totally agree with that because I'm in IT, right? And that is just the status quo for our jobs. It's whenever we switch jobs, we get like a 30% raise usually. And it's like, who doesn't want that? It's like, who does not want that? And so it's almost a no-brainer, but it does suck because it's like your coworkers do become your friends. You do get used to it. And guess what? You do build knowledge over very many years where it's like, hey, you can hire someone else, but they're not going to know about this specific area of the company that I am the expert on. And I think that stuff's going away. Let's get back to your son. So if he goes to college, whatever, he can fail. And let's say worst case, he's just living in your basement, in your pub, right? Sleeping on the sofa. Is that the plan?
That's not the plan, but it could be. It could be eventually the plan. He's obviously going to have to go find his own way at some point. But I think that there's like a fine line between, I'm not a kick them out at 18 and just good luck. Like, not at all. I think that there's, you know, there is kind of a virtue to that European system where, you know, like in Italy, you know, like the son will live with the family until he's married, or, you know, maybe not that long, depending on how long that is. But but I think that there is, you know, I want him around forever. Like, I don't care. Like, in our new home plan, we're going to build two additional like units on that are detached. So one would be like above a garage and one would just be a standalone unit. And like, you know, talking to another real estate friend of mine in New Jersey, he built something similar for his daughter, you know, in the back of his property. She lives there even now that she's married and has like two kids. You know, she pays him a little bit of rent just to kind of cover costs. But he's like, it's so much more important to have family nearby than just to kick him out and say good luck. You know, like if we can support them in any way, there's obviously a point where it's like coddling, or you're like paying for all their bills and they're not working. Like, that's not something that's going to happen. But if he's truly trying to make his own way and affordability is a problem, you know, like I want to be in the position where, you know, we'll help him out, we'll make it work, you know, instead of you know, leaving him to fend for himself in a world that's becoming more and more unaffordable. You know, it's like, I want him to be able to, you know, own a property. And, you know, even if he's renting out rooms to his friends, you know, like having that responsibility is important too, of, you know, ownership and, you know, managing tenants and whatever that looks like. And so, yeah, so there's a possibility that, you know, he doesn't do well in college and he comes back home, but there's also a possibility where he goes to college on the East Coast and, you know, and then, you know, and then my wife and I are very much like, wherever he ends up, you know, if he gets married and moves to Michigan, we'll probably move to Michigan. Like, that's just how we are. Because we only have one kid. And what's more important, like being nearby family or staying here and flying out to see him twice a year? Like, I can't, you know, I don't like that idea.
Like, holy shit. Okay, this is what a healthy family looks like, everybody. This is what it looks like. This is what it sounds like. This is what it feels like. This is what a good dad looks like. This is probably a good father-son relationship. This is awesome, right? Because I'll be honest, I would rather pull out my eyebrows one by one than go back and live with my parents. I would live in a car. And I told them that I'll live in a car before I live with y'all. I will be homeless. I don't care. But that is so beautiful. So are you kind of putting your home building plans on pause until y'all see what happens with college?
Not really. Cause I mean, I know that there's a possibility that he stays in state. And if that's the possibility, he could, you know, even if he goes away to college for 4 years and then comes back home and finds a job in Denver or starts a company in Denver or comes and works for me in Denver, you know, then that effort's not wasted, right? Like the 1.5 years of building process and, worst case scenario, we sell that house and we go build it in Michigan, you know, or whatever that looks like.
Wouldn't you take a huge loss?
Not necessarily. No, because being in real estate full time, like I could, you know, I would know what that house would be worth at the end of building it. And even if we have to like go in and, you know, tone down the speakeasy to sell it, we could probably do something like that. But yeah, we wouldn't be upside down in that house. And so, you know, I would probably treat it like a spec build, like some of my builder friends do. And then just knowing that I have, you know, equity from day one in that property. And so if we have to sell it a year or two later.
How do you have equity from day one? That seems like kind of crazy. I've always heard like it takes like, okay, you know, like the first 5 years, if you sell it, you're going to get absolutely raped. But you're six, seven, eight. Now you have equity. Now you're profitable.
No, and you're right. I mean, if you buy a house like top of market in your neighborhood, then yes, it will take some time to recoup at least those closing costs and those selling costs. Absolutely. You're not going into it with equity. Whereas if you're building, you obviously have to buy the land right. Like you can't overpay for the land. And then your build process just has to be in line with the area. So if you're building a $10 million house in a neighborhood that is, you know, every house is worth $400,000, that's probably not the scenario here. It's probably building like a $1 million house in a neighborhood that, you know, where houses go for 1.5. So in that scenario where you buy the land and you build, you're still under that top of neighborhood price. And so it's like one of those things where, I mean, that's how builders make money, right? So yeah. a builder builds for $1 million, sells for 1.4, you know, after costs and everything, they're probably netting $300,000 on that deal, you know? And so that's how spec builders make their money. And so we would just treat it like a spec build, make sure that we're, you know, on budget and that we're under what the neighborhood can support, you know, that's where the equity lies. So,
yeah. Is the neighborhood really that important? Is it most important?
Well, I mean, if you're on some levels, yeah. I mean, we have, you know, we've all heard of people who like over renovate their house. You know, they buy a $200,000 house, they put $150,000 in with granite and, you know, clawfoot tubs and all these things, and then they're surprised that they can't sell it because the houses in the neighborhood only go for like $230. You know, so yeah, and in this case, obviously you can't just build anywhere, and so we would pick a place to build where. You know, all of the comparable houses around us are within line of the price that we're building at. So, you know, you want to find like a $1.5 million neighborhood and be all in for $1 million, or that $500,000 neighborhood and be all in for $300,000, you know, like that kind of scenario.
Anson, you have just offended me again. You just described me in your dummy scenario what not to do. I bought a house. I bought a house during COVID, right? And for $200,000, it's like you're reading my mind. Oh my gosh, you're reading.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, bought it for $200,000. This is in South Louisiana, right? Low cost of living. Okay. Bought it for $200,000. Got in there. I assumed, I'm like, hey, I'm Anson. I'm gonna die in here. I'm gonna die in this.
Okay, house. Okay.
And so I'm like, all right, cool. You know, it was an older house, 1980s, 1975. So we redid the kitchen, fixed the foundation. We put about $70,000 into it in like the first year. And we sold it the second year and got absolutely fucked. I lost over 30 grand on this house.
Oh, no. Oh, man.
It was dumb. I should have called you.
Yeah, you should have. So like the neighbor, like you sold it for like 250 or 240 like or something?
Yeah, around there. It was like between 235, 240, I believe, something like that. And we did walk away. Like we walked away with, I think, 20 something grand in cash.
Okay.
It could not touch. We replaced the AC brand new. We fixed there was an in-ground pool. We spent like $5,000 on the in-ground pool to fix it. It was an older pool. We redid the kitchen. That was almost $20,000. Granite counters, all kind of stuff, dude, because I thought I was gonna die in this house, but circumstances changed and we sold it and we moved to Colorado Springs.
Oh, you're in the Springs. Oh, nice.
Right now.
Yeah. Ah, I did not know that. Okay, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately that, you know, that does happen. And if you, it can be easy to run away with that budget, right? So if the foundation needs to be fixed, it's something that needs to be fixed, whether you're living in it or you're definitely when you sell it, you know, someone else is going to want you to fix it, you know, that kind of thing. So, unfortunately that stuff does happen, you know, but hopefully the new place you're in is a little bit different scenario. Maybe not foundation repairs.
No, man. I think what we realize is that I guess maybe just house ownership is maybe not for me. Or at least I'll say this caveat. Old house ownership. And this was my first house, right? And so it was, I thought, you know, just kind of move in. Oh, there's a couple little things, no big deal. But living in an older house, it was just, it's hard to describe just all the little bitty things that would happen. Like, be like, man, this room is really, really drafty and I don't know why. Oh, wow. Why is this wall bulging? Oh, wow. Why is there a leak? Oh, now the lights don't work. Just weird stuff like this. And I was like, oh my goodness. And so I think it kind of burnt me to get that older house. I'm not a handyman. And to have to do all of this stuff, it was like, dude, it's more work than it was worth to me. So I think the next place I get is probably going to be like a modern, like just give me a townhouse, man. What would your advice be? Like the lowest maintenance type of property I could own.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, if you need a little bit more room than a condo, then something like a townhouse or a row house where either the HOA takes care of the exterior. So they're in charge of the roof and the, you know, the siding and the paint and all of that stuff, concrete and everything else that's on the outside. And you're only responsible for, you know, inside repairs. That would probably be the lowest maintenance option for sure. And there's a bunch of new builds, you know, going on here between here and the Springs. Like I just drove through the Springs last week. So, you know, there's building everywhere. Out there, and there's a lot of attached, you know, kind of townhome, row homes that would probably be like the newer you buy, the idea is that there's no deferred maintenance or your deferred maintenance goes away. You know, you won't have to touch the AC, the furnace, the hot water heater, the, you know, update the kitchen. You won't have to do any of those things for a long time, like at least 10, 15, 20 years on some of those systems. And so that's where a lot of, you know, clients of mine go when they don't want maintenance. They just go like, I want something that's built 2018 or newer, you know. Right. It's like, all right, you know, then you know what you're getting and you're not getting into a lot of those little things that people have, like my problem is things that people try to fix over time. So like we'll be in a house that was built in the 30s and we're like, you know, you're peeling back walls, you're tearing down you're basically just tearing out everything that previous owners have done, but they did it poorly. So you're like tearing out, you know, bad work, or like houses where they've added on to it over the years. So like, here's the 50s edition and here's the 80s edition that they made to the house. I'm with you, man. I do not like living in an old house. I like the idea of it. I love the look of old houses, some of them, but living in it sucks because there are a million problems with them. And so, yeah, I don't blame you, man. That's I'm with you on that. Team new house. Let's go.
Yeah, team new house. What advice would you give to somebody? And I'm kind of in this boat too, to where it's like a lot of people are waiting on the interest rate to drop, right?
Sure.
And a lot of people are like, man, I want to buy a house right now. I have the money to buy a house, right? It's in savings, whatever. I have enough for a down payment, all of this stuff. I kind of want to do that, but I feel like I'm getting screwed in the market today if I do it.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a catch-22, because if you wait too long and interest rates fall, that just means that it's going to open up more competition. There's going to be a bunch of sellers and buyers rushing to buy and list their homes. You know, it's like, and so like I'm thinking that between now and when rates adjust downward, like in Q3, like if you need something now ish, I would say start looking like right now, because even if you're locked in at a, you know, 6.8% rate or something like that, when rates do go down, just talk to your lender. Just say like, what would this look like when I refinance? How much would I owe, you know, like on closing costs or whatever. A lot of times it's worth it to buy now and then refinance later. And so if you can afford it, right now is a decent time, because they're, you know, the market's still a little bit slow. There's a lot of buyers sitting on the fence. We're seeing like more concessions from sellers. They're saying like, we'll pay some of your closing costs, or we'll give you credits for repairs or whatever that looks like. Whereas in maybe 6 months from now, with a big flood of buyers, you know, now it just turns like right back to a seller's market completely, and they hold all the cards. Right now, there's a little bit of play where properties are sitting on the market a little bit longer, and buyers have a little bit more opportunity to play with price, concessions. And yeah, you can't change that rate. That rate is what it is. But in 6 months or a year, if it adjusts downwards, you win because you can refinance. If it adjusts upwards, you win because you're locked in here, you know? And so sometimes waiting on the sidelines doesn't pay off, because if something happens and rates adjust upwards, you're just sitting on the sidelines for another year, year and a half or two until they come back down. And so, you know, my dad bought, you know, a house in like 1980. And his interest rate's like 18% in 1980. And so, you know, and he showed me where every like 4 years he just refinanced. So he went from 18% to 15%. 15 to 12, 12 to 9, you know, 9 to 6, 6 to 4, you know. And then if you bought anytime if you refinanced in like 2021, you know, like my brother-in-law is sitting on like a 2% loan or something like that. Like, you'll never get rid of that house.
You offended me again. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Hey, we're about to virtually fist fight. 2.6 was my interest rate, dude.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and there is an option there where you could, you know, time machine, we'll go back in time. If you didn't need that 20 grand in cash, like right away, there is an option there where you could have rented it for like 5 years until the equity caught up, and then sold it and probably netted a little bit more money. Because with that low interest rate, you have kind of a low risk exposure. Like, there's almost no way that you couldn't find a tenant to at least cover your costs, if not make money on top of that. So but not everybody's in that situation. Some people like, I need that 20 grand to move to Colorado Springs, or I need that 20 grand to, you know, XYZ. So not everybody's in that situation, but that could have been a play with a time machine and a lot of hindsight.
I did not need the 20 grand and I thought about renting it. But you know what the big thing in my brain was A, I've never rented a property. B, I'm going to be out of state, so I can't even manage it. And there are property management. And then C, and this was the big kicker for me, I had a in-ground pool in the backyard. And I don't know how, like, I don't, because to upkeep it, it's a fucking lot of work to upkeep that pool, man.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I don't know, would I have to hire a pool guy to do that? That's very expensive. And so yeah. I'm really losing my ass on the rent. I didn't know how to juggle that.
Yeah. Like, do you, like, what was your payment roughly?
Like $1,000 a month, 1100.
And for that size of house in, was it Southern Louisiana? Do you think it could have rented for like 1400, somewhere around there?
I do. Yeah. I think that would have been about, I probably could have got that between maybe like 14 and 1700 to the person. It was like 1600 square feet, fenced in backyard, three beds.
Granite.
granite, brand new kitchen, granite, brand new appliances, all this good stuff. So I'm thinking I could have got that. I was just like, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like I'm out of my comfort zone and I'm trying to make educated decisions that cost lots of money. And so I was just like, ooh, let me not do this. And so
I didn't do there it. Is, I mean, no, you know, no judgment at all. 'Cause that is a huge decision and managing from afar is a lot tougher than, well, I guess mentally it's a lot tougher to get over of like, that's a risk tolerance that not everybody has, right? So property management obviously would be key. And then what I would, because pool is liability, like pools equal liability to me. What I would have done is probably put like one of those semi-solid pool covers on, drained it. And I don't know, I haven't owned a pool, so I don't know if that hurts the pool to leave it drained, but you know, like drain it, cover it, and just like leave it out of the lease. Otherwise, you have to have like some sort of disclosure or waivers for your renters on that pool because you don't want to be liable for anything that would happen. Or like in Arizona, they put it's basically like the law that you have to have a closing, like a self-closing gated system around your pool so that like toddlers. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, at least you had some of that. But yeah, I mean, that could have been a scenario where that would cost, you know, like $1,000 to cover the pool and just block it off and just say like, no pool for you. But the house is nice enough to where, you know, you can still command, you know, decent rent and stuff. So, you know, all hindsight aside, that is an option, but it's not for everybody. It, you know, obviously you thought through it and it wasn't to your risk tolerance, which is totally fine.
You know what? I genuinely wish I would have talked to you because I did not even think about that option. That is such a good, because the pool was the kicker. It really was. I was open to it. And like I said, I was even open to maybe losing a couple dollars a month.
Yeah.
On it. And then eventually it'll catch up, like you said. But it was just like the pool, the liability, the gates, the kids, all of this. I didn't think for a single second, man, that just drain it, semi hard cover on it.
Yep.
Bam. That's what it is. Because a lot of people don't even, you know, like to have to deal with pools. So it may even make the property more attractive.
Yeah. Or, you know, get a pool service, upcharge the rent. So it's like a premium, you know, it's a super premium listing, right? So it's, you got a pool, you got a renovated house. And have a lawyer draft just a like a airtight kind of a liability waiver for the renters. Because people rent houses with pools all the time. It's just not my experience. Yeah. You know, like I have friends in Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, like Ohio, you know, like they own houses with pools that they rent. So it's possible. Not my favorite risk thing, but there are ways to probably mitigate that risk, but you know, you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, you did what's best for you. And, you know, now you're in Colorado, which is better.
way better, dude. Way better. No, that is not controversial at all.
Yeah.
Like if I were to rent out the property, whether it be one with like high liability with a pool or just a regular one, do you recommend starting an LLC and have that be the renter? Or because if I don't know how it works, if a kid died and sued me, would like I go to jail or would the LLC take it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So like the ownership of the house would have to be in that LLC for you to be fully protected. And in most people's cases, banks don't like lending to LLCs unless you're doing like an investment style loan. That's, you know, so you converting your owner occupied house in your name into a rental, you would not be absolved from like liability unless you had some sort of liability contract with, you know, like here's your lease agreement and here's the pool waiver, like drafted by a lawyer that I paid, you know, $1,500 for this one page document. Like that would probably be your best bet. But in general, if you're investing, you know, like I am, you are setting up LLCs for properties to, and it's mainly like cross exposure. So if I have 10 properties in one LLC and something happens at one of them, somebody who sues that LLC can now go after all 10 of those properties. And so most people keep like one or two properties in an LLC if they're going to be buying, you know, multiple properties. So in your case, it would probably be a lot harder to transfer that property into an LLC in order to do that. And so your best bet would probably just be, you know, have a really good rental contract and have some sort of waiver or liability addendum to that contract.
Holy shit, man. That stuff is so scary. How do you handle leases? I used to have a buddy who had rental properties, and he said all of his leases are month to month, just from the get-go. He said because it gave him the flexibility to kick the person out, and it gave the person also flexibility to leave.
Yeah.
What type of like lease agreements do you do for your tenants?
Yeah. So we have, we have two different kinds. One is just a traditional year to year lease. I feel like month to month, people don't feel secure on their side. You know, they're saying like, well, my landlord could kick me out anytime. And there is, you know, we were talking about loyalty a little bit earlier. I mean, there are loyal tenants who, if you treat them right, and if you take care of them and you're like responsive and you fix things as they need to be fixed and you're fair, you're not, you know, trying to gouge every cent out of people. There are loyal tenants. And so having that year security isn't just for you and be like, well, this is a one-sided contract. I can kick you out anytime. Imagine being the tenant and you're like, well, I can get kicked out anytime. Like, why do I, you know, why am I loyal or why do I want to take care of the property? You know? And so that goes both ways. So I'm not opposed to a year long lease. And then on the other hand, we do room by room leases as well. And so there are certain properties where we don't treat the entire property, like a 5-bedroom house, as one lease. We'll actually set up 5 different leases on, because there are room by room tenants who are, you know, they're usually guys and gals who are, you know, fresh out of college. They have a professional job. They just don't want to go pay $2,000 a month for a 1-bedroom apartment. You know, they would rather pay $1,000 for a shared space, but it's nice. Like all the common areas are furnished. You know, there's like house cleaning once a month that we bring in. You know, we're catering to professional, you know, young professionals who are okay with that living situation. It's affordable, which is a win for them. And for us, you know, we actually do make a little bit more money than if we rented it out to one tenant who had all 5 bedrooms. And so those are kind of the two different leases. That one, it depends on the usually those are like 6-month leases just in case they move or they find a job, you know, in Chicago or whatever, and they move on. And then we do midterm rentals and some short-term rentals, but those aren't under leases. Those are just like a 3-month agreement on a midterm rental. And short-term rental is just what it is. It's the Vrbo or Airbnb person coming in for 3 days at a time or whatever.
Whenever you rent out each room, like you're saying, you have like, let's say a five-bedroom house, five leases, five people in there. How do you deal with the roommate who's just a fucking asshole, right? Because we've all had one. Like the guy is like, hey, yo, is it in the lease that this guy should at least clean up the damn bathroom after he destroyed it or do the dishes? Like, how do you deal with that? Because couldn't that like rotten the whole house that you have one asshole in there?
It can. So first of all, like some of those things are in the lease of like how to treat common areas, which would include the bathroom, the kitchen, the living room, garage, yard, like all of those are considered common areas. So that's in the lease. And so we've, there are property management companies now that actually handle room by room leases. And so what they'll do is they'll deal with the problem people by moving them into a different property or terminating their lease, or, you know, obviously if it's a huge problem, there's always going to be personality conflicts. In those situations, you get like two humans together and eventually they won't get along, you know? And so they'll either move them into another house or property, whether it's owned by you or not. You know, they'll just break the lease and have a new lease with the new owner. I've had where they've moved like from one of my properties to another one of my properties. Just, you know, that thankfully property management takes care of that, because if I had to manage people like that, I think I would go insane. So I just make sure that they're taken care of. But I don't want to like get into their interpersonal roommate problems. So
why don't you manage your own properties? Wouldn't you save a lot of money?
I would save money, but I would, it would take up so much of my time, honestly. So like, I couldn't do things like this, which is more fun than, well, at some point you just got to decide like what dollar per hour, like your time is worth, or what, you know, what tasks are worth, you know, a certain dollar per hour. And so there is a world where I could manage 30 properties and it would take me like 10 hours a month, and that's manageable. And then there's that same world where there's four or five problems going on in a month and it takes me, you know, 100 hours a week to handle those same problems. And so for me, it's worth the 10% of the rent to offboard that onto somebody else who can actually have, that's their full-time job, is to take care of tenants. And so they handle obviously the turnover, they handle vetting tenants, they handle repairs, and they handle any kind of interpersonal problems like that. And I feel like that's well worth it. Like I could make 10% extra money, sure, but that would take up probably 50% of my time. So it's a trade-off there.
Yeah. You also mentioned earlier that like you were talking about your loyal tenants and how you don't try to like squeeze every dime out of them. Well, how do you sleep at night knowing that you're kind of leaving money on the table? Aren't you like a greedy capitalist? Aren't you?
That's right. That's, no.
Because here's the thing, because every single person who's had a landlord is just like, oh my gosh, my rent's going up 20% in a year or 10, like something outrageous. Like, how do you deal with that? You are leaving money on the table.
Yeah. In a lot of cases you are. But there is like a groundswell, which I'm really happy about. Right. So I'm pretty heavily involved in the investor community. Like I run a meetup group, you know, and I get to talk to investors every single month. There is this kind of groundswell of younger investors who want to do this thing more ethically, you know, more win-win. And so they're not just going, I'm going to buy this fourplex, kick out all these people who have been here for 10 years, you know, renovate it and get top dollar. Like that's a thing. And that is a way to make money. But I don't think I could sleep if I'm kicking out grandma in order to make an extra $200 a month or whatever, like maybe $500. No, I'm just kidding.
Got a price. Totally. Fuck grandma.
Totally kidding. But it's like, there's no like official like meetup group of people who want to do this ethically. It's just the more I talk to people, especially if they're younger, Unfortunately, like older investors, they still just kind of want as much money as possible for the most part.
They have no soul.
They have no soul. But the kids are all right. You know, they're coming up. They see opportunities to provide housing that's affordable, and they've probably been screwed by landlords, and they don't like it. They don't like that feeling. So they don't want to be on the other side of that. So I couldn't sleep at night if I was out there just doing one-sided deals and gouging everybody. That's something that I couldn't sleep with. I would rather leave money on the table, quote unquote, and do right by people. And I think if you do that, like if you're people first and you're service first, you're like at the end of the day, you are going to impact more people. You're going to make more money. You're going to sleep at night, which is priceless.
Totally, man. And honestly, you're such a breath of fresh air, dude. As a tenant, I am like, I'm not just like, I don't look at my landlord like a piece of shit or anything like that. I look at them as like, hey, this is a relationship. And I've had landlords who have gone the extra mile in maybe just doing a repair. Maybe like the AC was out and they gave me like speedy service and they made sure it was done in like 3 days. And I totally reciprocate that as a tenant. Like, I will take care of your shit. Listen, I'll make sure the walls are clean, do the spring cleaning. I'll, you know, report anything that's weird. Like, it's totally reciprocated. And I just wish more folks would do that, because as a tenant, I feel it. And I'm like, hey, you know what? I want to be a good tenant for this guy. I think maybe the older generation doesn't also, maybe they're not taking into account that, hey, we have the internet now. And if you are a shitty property management company or you are a shitty landlord, people are going to know. Like, you live in Denver, go to the Denver like subreddit and just like search for the word landlord, and you will find the shittiest landlords in the city. And so that reputation is super important, man. And I'm glad you do operate that way.
No, and I was going to bring up that exact example, because like every week there's like, don't move into this building. I should have read the reviews. I should have listened. Yes. Unfortunately, property management and corporate owners, like it's easy to not care if you're a corporate owner. You know, it's like, it's no skin off their back. You know, eventually it might catch up to them, but they might just sell the building and then you have a new corporate owner, you know, coming in and doing the same thing eventually. But yeah, you're right. Like, the internet exists, and the word gets around for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, man. In fact, I would really like to rent from people like you. It's like,
hey, all right.
This guy has, you know, he's not bigcompany.com or whatever. He's just, hey, he's a guy, just a regular guy, family guy, who's obviously a great dad. Dude, you should put that. Put that great on the apartment listing. Like, yeah, I am a great dad, because like, these are the type of people I want to rent from. I don't want to rent from like, hey, my stuff's broken. And they're like, oh, you have to talk to our hotline. And it's like, this is like, I wonder, is there a website for like rentfromsmallcompany.com?
Man, I wish there was. I would say, it would be hard to kind of suss that out, wouldn't it? Yeah. On the tenant side, to do like your research on the ownership of a property and see who owns it before you kind of go in and apply for, because even if you have that property management front, it could be, you know, it could be an 80-year-old guy, you know, who's above board and loves taking care of tenants, or it could be a corporation. You just don't know, because you're just dealing with the property management company or that person at the property management company. That's a good, I think there's a good opportunity there for, for a listing.
Maybe it's in the reviews, right?
I don't know.
What advice would you give to a person who does not have a lot of money and they're trying to purchase a property?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously first time home buyer programs out there for a reason, that have like low money down. Here in Colorado, we have both FHA, which is a federal, well, they're not federal, but 3.5% down on the loan. And then we have a Colorado program that actually pays that 3.5% for you. So it's called CHAFA here. There's probably one in every state, something like that. Ours is like Colorado Housing, whatever. So there are kind of down payment assistance programs for first-time home buyers or people who don't have necessarily the money or, you know, the best credit in the world. There are programs for you, which is nice. There are some drawbacks to some of those. Like FHA does carry mortgage insurance, which is, you know, between $100 and $200 a month. You know, it could be higher, but somewhere around there. So you have your payment plus your mortgage insurance now. But you got in with 3.5% down, which, you know, on a $200,000 property, you're talking, you know, $5,000 on the down payment plus your closing costs. There'll be closing costs no matter what. But you don't have to save up, you know, $50,000 to get into a property. There are options out there for that. And if you want to get creative, there are ways to kind of in our side, we call it house hacking, which is basically you buy a property to live in and you live in one part of the property and you rent out part of the other property the other part of the property. So this could even look like you buy a house and you live in one bedroom and you rent out, you know, the other two bedrooms on the, you know, on the main floor or whatever. You buy a house, you live on the top part and you rent out the basement. You know, you buy a duplex, you live on one side of the duplex, you rent out the other side of the duplex. Honestly, there's like no better way to buy real estate, in my opinion, which is why on my podcast that I just started, like our entire first season is just dealing with house hackers. Like it's such a powerful thing for, you know, we have clients and people who I've interviewed so far in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. Some have families, you know, some are single, some are married. Like it's not just the young kids, you know, the 20-year-olds who are house hacking. It's like my friend Katie is 40 in her mid-40s with a husband and a little dog, and she house hacks, you know. And my friend Dan, he's in his late 30s, two kids and a dog, and he house hacks, you know. And so it's not just for young people who can't afford another solution. It is actually just a really powerful way to offset some of your living expenses in order to kind of make housing more affordable. And it could be like we have house hackers who, you know, they live in the house or they live in the townhome or whatever it looks like, and they just rent out the garage to somebody else. Like even something as little as that. Or there are, you know, there's websites where you can advertise space for rent. So like if you have a basement and it's unfinished, so you can't put a family down there or something. but there's a bunch of storage down there that you don't use. You can actually rent out that storage by the square foot, you know? And even if that's $200, let's just say it's $200 a month that somebody's paying you for your garage or an RV pad in your backyard. You know, some people have like, I have an entire backyard and somebody parks their RV out there. They plug into my electricity so that their batteries don't discharge, but they're paying me, you know, $200 a month. Like even that $200 a month that pays for your cell phone bill, that pays for your internet, that could pay for your, you know, your streaming services, that could pay for whatever. But if you could find out creative ways to kind of chip off little parts of your housing expense, it's so insanely powerful. Like for some of my clients and the people I've interviewed, they're living there for free. I mean, they're living at home for free because they built out a basement unit that they put on Vrbo, and it pays, you know, it brings in $3,500 a month, you know. Or my friend Kim in Denver, she rents out half of her duplex to like travel nurses because it's close to a hospital. So they're on like 3-month contracts. That pays her $4,500 a month for that. And so she lives at home for free. So she's building equity. She gets the tax benefits. And, you know, she provides housing in a market where housing is scarce. And they, you know, people like that need options. And, you know, she's living there for free, which you can't say, you know, I can't say that. Like, yeah. Wait, but
what are the tax benefits? You mentioned that. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, for owning a home, you do have mortgage, you know, like interest rate deductions. And so you can take your interest rate as a deduction on your taxes. And if you are renting out a space, so like if you have a closed off basement space that you're renting, or like Kim, she has half of her duplex that she's renting, the expenses that she has for the, you know, for that side of her property, she can actually just take as deductions, as basically expenses. And so it's like keeping track of, you know, the toilet paper that you're buying, if it's like a short-term rental or something, like the towels, the furniture, the toilet paper, you know, like all of those things, those are technically business expenses. And so you can claim those on your taxes, and that comes off of the income that it's, that, that it's generating. So it's like,
that is awesome, man.
There's a million ways to skin the cat on affordability, whether it's just an affordable FHA loan, all the way to something super creative where you're trying to offset any part of your living expense, which is pretty huge.
Well, you just got like visibly, like you physically changed whenever we started talking about house hacking.
Yeah.
So this is also like, this is your jam, it seems like. What's the most popular style or flavor of house hacking?
Oh man. I would say, because I'm on episode 8, so I've interviewed 4 people so far. Each one of them has done it differently, you know? And so I would say, a lot of people think of the rent by room scenario, but that's not for everybody. Like, I would not get into that scenario because I'm married and have kids and 2 dogs and whatever. So I wouldn't want like strangers living down the hall for me. But if you're just out of college, that could be, you know, a great solution for you. I'd say most typical is probably that duplex scenario. Yeah. Where you, but it, there's like a visible cutoff of here's your side of the property, here's my side of the property, or that up down basement unit. You know, here in Denver, we have a ton of these, you know, 60s built, 50s built properties where it's a 1200 square foot ranch with a 1200 square foot basement. You know, it's like put a separate entrance in there, or you know, block off the stairs or whatever that looks like, put a kitchen down there, make the windows so that you can egress, so it's like a legal, you know, safe thing. And then that's a whole unit, you know, down below you. And so probably those two scenarios of either creating a basement unit as like a duplex or having like a side-by-side duplex.
So if you're not afraid of creepy people, maybe rent it out room by room, because you may get some creepers.
You could.
Also, too, like, wouldn't they be on their best behavior because they're living in the house with their landlord? Isn't that weird?
You would think so. Some of those guys, they'll do a midterm or short-term rental for those bedrooms. Tanner, who I just interviewed down in the Springs, his first house hack was like, I think he had 2 extra bedrooms and he just rented them on Airbnb. And so he had new people coming in every, you know, 2 or 3 days, and they didn't necessarily know that he was the owner. Like, they were just like, oh, there's a guy down the hall. Like, cause you don't typically pay attention if you're like, I've done Airbnb by the bedroom once, like up in Keystone. I was there for a conference, and I didn't interact or talk to anybody else who was there. They could have been the owner. They could have been the Queen of England. I don't know. Like, I was out all day, came back to sleep, and that was it. And I think that that's kind of a pretty common scenario for those kind of situations. But yeah, I mean, some people are weird about that. Like, even on a duplex scenario, they're like, should I tell them that I'm the owner, or do I just like let property management take care of that, or just play dumb?
Oh, like, it's a great question. Listen, if it was me, no, I am trying to assert my dominance. I'm putting signs in their yard. I am the owner. Putting another sign, like putting stuff on their window. Shh, be quiet. You know, I'll raise your rent if you sass me.
No, that's right.
And this is why I'm not a landlord, and I never should be. Yeah. How hard is it to own properties and to rent it out in Colorado? Isn't everybody a huge fucking pothead, and don't all of your properties reek of weed?
No, that hasn't been my experience at all.
How do you stop it though? Do you put it in the lease?
For weed, No, it's not in the lease. Smoking is. And so that should take care of both of those things. Like no smoking inside. Like, and then if it's like a room by room scenario, we will kind of say like, try to stay like 15 feet away from the property, because there's people in there who also, you know, who may not smoke as well. So I don't know. I mean, everybody here, like, they'll either have their weed gummies, or I don't know a lot of people who smoke anymore. Like most people just have like gummies or something. So
they'll vape.
Or vape. Yeah. I'm not too worried about vape. Vape smells. It'll smell like blue raspberry or something in there.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like an air freshener. What about like balconies? That's what always bugged me. It's like, why can't I smoke on the balcony, dude?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I hate cigarette smoke, like the smell of it and stale. I've been through too many houses that smell just like somebody smoked in there for 40 years. So maybe I'm just hypersensitive to it, but yeah, I mean, we do ask them to like take at least, you know, 20 steps away from the property to, if they're going to smoke, cause it does waft in and it gets everywhere. So, you know, we have that in the lease so that if they move out and the property just reeks of smoke, like we have some sort of remedy, like we'll hold back $500 for cleaning or something like that. Like try to be fair with it, but that's like something that's like, I don't know. I don't smoke, so I don't understand it.
Have you ever tried it?
Have I tried smoking? Yeah. Like in eighth grade.
Weed or cigarettes or both?
Cigarettes then, lasted like, I don't know, like a month, because I thought I was cool. And then I just didn't. I was either too broke to afford cigarettes in eighth grade, or just didn't. I didn't enjoy it. But weed, yeah, no, I've never been like a huge weed smoker. So
that's awesome, dude. That's
not my thing.
And I don't know why people. I don't know what like media firm or whatever was behind smoking cigarettes, but damn, they are good, because. Yo, it looks so cool. Everyone sees it and looks cool. Like, I talk to like teenagers and they're like, oh man, I want to try a cigarette. But, and you probably know this. If you smoke a cigarette, it is like one of the worst, like your first 10 cigarettes you smoke, it is like the worst experience of your fucking life.
It's totally. Terrible. Oh yeah. Like lightheaded, like you feel sick. Coughing. Yeah. And that is the funny thing. Like we've been my wife and I have been watching like some older, just some older shows, and like everybody's smoking at all times. And it was like such a cultural thing. Like my dad smoked when he was younger. My mom smoked when she was younger. My grandparents smoked when they were younger. But I feel like it's so rare now. And maybe it varies by state. Colorado, we're like very health conscious. We're very like, you know, I don't personally know anybody who smokes, like friends, colleagues, nobody's stepping out, you know, of my meetup where there's like, you know, between 40 and 70 people there. Nobody's stepping out to go smoke in the parking lot. You know, it's like, I don't like nobody. I know. I can't think of one person that smokes that's not like under 70 years old. You know, like, it's like everybody just, like it feels like it's kind of a stigma now, like, you know. And I don't know, maybe it's just maybe I hang out with the right people and they're not bad influences on me. I don't know.
I don't know. So and you also mentioned, I think, something that's really smart for people who maybe aren't in Colorado. Colorado is a very health conscious state, in my opinion. I haven't been there long, less than a year.
Okay.
And I'm trying to get my parents to move out here, and I'll tell you why. The old people in Colorado, and I say old, right? They're not old. 55 and up people in Colorado are the most badass people I've ever seen in my life. Oh my God. I've never seen, it's a whole different species. These people are not regular. Don't let them tell you they're regular. They're not. So I go on these hiking trails, right? Just like a week ago, I'm hiking up in, you know, we got all the mountains, Pikes Peaks, all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
And it's after snow. So right, the trail is snowed over. You know, there's a packed down area. And I am getting my literal ass kicked. I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, I'm like stumbling, twisting my ankle and stuff. And a couple runs by me. They're jogging Oh, he's just jogging. The guy looks like he's at least 65. He has a long gray ponytail, looks like a hippie. Yeah. And the girl looks like she's like 57 in leg. She looks great, by the way. Great body, in great shape. And I say, this is an antidote, but I've had this happen multiple times. These old people on the trails, they're like freaking robots, man. Is it something in the water? Like, what? I've never seen this. I've lived in California. I've lived in other states. I've never seen anything like this, man. If you want to extend your life, move to California, move to Colorado, because these old folks, there's something in the water, man.
There is. No, I've lived on the west. I grew up here, so I've lived like west of the Mississippi my entire life. So anytime I go, if like this is going to sound bad, so don't judge me too harshly out there, internet. But anytime I go east of the Mississippi, I feel like I go to a different country. Yes. Like, because if I go to California, Washington, Oregon, like people are health conscious. They're outdoors. They're on the running trails. They're biking. They're hiking. They're paddleboarding. Like that's just ingrained. Mostly like in us, like we're skiing, we're snowboarding, we're camping, we're hiking, whatever. I'll go to like Ohio where one of my brothers lives, and it's just a different, like nobody goes outside, like nobody's out on the hiking trail. There's it's few and far between, but here it's not uncommon to have like, I'll hit up one of my friends, or my wife will hit up one of her friends like on a weekend, and like our activities usually are around either like hiking, paddleboarding, or something outdoors, basically. We're not jumping on an ATV. We're not going boating. Like we're doing something that's at least physical, I'm not a super skinny guy, but I still get out there and I'll go hike and, like Manitou Springs, like right by you, we'll go do the incline, or we'll go do stuff like that. Cause that's just what we do here. I don't know what it is. And I don't know, like living in Louisiana, was it like, see anything like this?
Oh my gosh. South Louisiana is statistically one of the fattest places in America. And I was born and raised in South Louisiana.
Okay.
And it is just the culture, and it's just so hard to describe. Like I'm not a good enough speaker to describe it, but it impacts you. Like whatever the culture is of your environment, we're all products of our environment. And for example, South Louisiana, what do you do to have fun? You drink alcohol, you party, and you have lots of sex. That's it, man. That's all we do. And it's like, people are like, if you just go into the grocery store, everyone's a little bit bigger. Everyone, you could tell they're just very unhealthy. No one's out walking. Yeah. And also there isn't a lot of places to walk. And if there are, like they don't have like the public infrastructure and stuff. They don't have lots of trails or anything like this. And it may be for good reason, because it's hot as the devil's ass crack all the time. So it's like, and it's that weird heat too, where you just step outside and you're just wet, right, from the humidity. Yeah. And so it's one of the reasons I came to Colorado.
Okay.
Because that culture, man, I feel like I live the exact same life, but in Louisiana, I'm like 20 pounds heavier and a little bit more depressed. And then over here, or like I've lived in California is exact. I totally agree with what you said, by the way, because I've seen the exact same thing in California. I just did not see the gangster old people in California.
Okay.
But you're right. Like you go to the beach and you're like, oh, I'm at the beach. And it's like, well, no, like these guys are running in sand. Like everyone's jogging, everyone's biking. You're out. It's 75 and sunny. But man, I feel that culture, or that whatever you want to call it in Colorado, man, like that, hey, get out and do something. And it's contagious. And I love it, man. I love Colorado.
That's good. Yeah. I think about it every now and then, and I haven't lived, in the South or something like that, where there is that difference. But, talking to my brother who grew up here and now lives in Ohio in the Midwest, and yeah, it is a total just culture difference. It's just like, you go to the beach to go, to hang out, and then you go to restaurants or whatever, and you're like on vacation. Like that's the beach, where California, you know, they're surfing every morning, or they're like paddleboarding, or they're swimming, or they're training for triathlons or whatever it is. Not to say that people don't do that in Louisiana, but it's not ingrained in that culture of like growing up doing things outside. Outside is terrible because I hate humidity. So if I was in Louisiana and I grew up there, I'd be inside 24/7 just sitting right next to the air conditioner. So
that's exactly what I did. Now they like to hunt and fish, but even then it's just
okay. Yeah,
it is. Come on, man. It makes a difference, man. If a person is like in a funk and they're just like, damn, I'm depressed and stuff like this, yo, just find a different environment. Like, you'll be surprised at how much it will impact you. I wanted to ask you about something. This is the only question I'm like, I cannot let him get off without me asking. Uh-oh. Because I'm really uneducated on this, and maybe you have a better opinion. What happened with the like the real estate commission fee, like lawsuit that happened? Could you give me a rundown on that? What is that?
Yeah, so like in a nutshell, there's always been just this kind of like unnamed, it's just kind of like a I don't know what you'd call it. Like, it's just tradition where the seller would pay for the commission for both their agent and the buyer's agent. So that was just kind of tradition. Everything's negotiable. So it was always negotiable. Like I don't want to pay the buyer's agent commission. But it's been going on for so long that buyers, like, they don't build in paying their own agent commission. It's just built into the MLS where it's like they're offering a co-op commission to that buyer's agent. It's listed right there in MLS, like, so you know exactly what you're going to get paid. And so basically, some people got together, they sued like the National Association of Realtors, saying that it was like an antitrust thing. Like, we're fixing the prices, right? We're like, and I guess some ways we are, right? Like, or I guess they are. So now you have to basically, like, as a buyer's agent, I have to inform my buyers, like, hey, the seller may not want to pay my commission. So we're going to have to figure out something else. We'll either have to negotiate for it when we negotiate for the purchase of the home, or there'll be something in there where the buyer pays part of my commission or all of my commission as part of their closing costs. So it's kind of flipping the system on its head a little bit because that's different. But now when I have a listing, I have to call that listing agent and ask them if there is any co-op commission that the seller is willing to pay, or if it's something that we have to negotiate. And so, you know, for the longest time, like, the seller's eating that cost, right? So if you're buying a $200,000 house, they're paying 6% commission, let's just say. And so they're paying $6,000 to each agent. So they're paying like $12,000, right? Mm-hmm. Technically, you as the buyer are still paying for that because you're just financing it into your loan. So if you're paying that full $200, you know, the seller's paying that out of their proceeds, but you're still paying, you know, you're paying them that money so that they can then pay the agents. And so, like, now it's just a little bit more upfront for possibly that buyer. And so that's kind of it in a nutshell. Agents are still trying to figure out, like, how to deal with it. Like, I have a bunch of trainings and meetings with my brokerage that are coming out of, like, you know, how to communicate this to buyers and sellers so that we're, you know, above board and that we're communicating. I honestly, at the end of the day, I think it's going to, like, things will, like, sellers will be like, oh, I don't have to pay this amount. Mm-hmm. Buyers have been so used to not having to pay it out of pocket that there's just going to be some sort of tension there for a while. And I think it might actually just snap back to the old system of, like, if the sellers have equity to pay it and the buyer's agent is bringing them a verified buyer, that's worth the money, right? That's worth that $6,000 to have a buyer come in and be verified. Because you know, Reddit has a lot of things to say about it that I don't necessarily agree with, but as an agent who's like in the middle of this, and I have buyers and sellers both right now who are getting ready to either buy or, you know, get ready to list or whatever, I'll have to have those conversations with them, of course, but everybody's still sort of trying to figure it out. But in a nutshell, it's just like, we have to tell buyers and sellers that everything's negotiable. You don't have to offer a, you know, a co-op fee for the buyer's agent. And there's a possibility where the buyers have to just pay for that out of pocket or go without an agent and, you know, go in to the transaction unrepresented. So okay, that's kind of like what's happening. It's probably more complicated than that, but that's the real world, I think, implications of it.
I heard it was something like what would happen is you would go to like purchase a house or something like that. And then if your agent did not like charge a certain fee or whatever, then the seller's agent would be like, hey, I'm sorry. I can't do business with that agent. Is that how it was, or is that wrong?
I mean, there is a thing where you, so like even on the old system, like, you know, if a listing is offering 1% as a co-op and the norm is 2.5-3%, something like that, technically I can't steer my buyer away from that listing because I'm not doing a fiduciary duty to them of, you know, showing them the best properties that meet their criteria based on, like, if I'm not showing them that property based on what I'm getting paid, I'm technically like in violation of my fiduciary duty to that buyer. So they're, you know, like that system is built in. Now, did it get followed? I don't know. There's probably agents who are like, 1%, I'm not even going to send them that listing. Like, that probably exactly did happen.
Isn't it like it's a race to the bottom? Like, let's just say hypothetically, everyone's charging 5% for just a nice round number.
Right.
And then you got like a handful of agents who's like, screw it, I'll do it for one. Doesn't it just screw over all of the agents, right? Because now it's a race to the bottom. Now, in order to compete, you got to charge 0.5%. And to beat that, is that like kind of the dynamic you were seeing and the dynamic that some of these realtors were trying to stop by saying, hey, look, if they're charging like something crazy low, I'm not even sending you that listing.
Yeah. I mean, we've had like a glut of discount brokerages that are flat fee brokerages that have come through and been like, we'll list it for 1%, or we'll, you know, Redfin does like a rebate on their commission. Cause I think that their agents are salary or something like that. So there has been some disruption on that, like race to the bottom, so to speak. But like quality usually has snapped back. So like somebody will use a discount brokerage on a purchase or something. They realize that they're not getting anywhere near the level of service that they would get because it's some of that's built into the contract. So if you're doing a discount listing, it'll say like, we're not going to do these five things. Like, no. And so the next time that they go to buy or sell, they might snap back and say like, well, I want to be taken care of and not have to deal with all of this stuff, right? So some of those people will go back to, you know, see the value, I guess, in that system. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there have been problems in Colorado with brokers who are steering away from discount listings. There's a company in town that was like only offering like a flat fee for the buyer's agent. Mm-hmm. And so there were brokerages and probably agents who got in trouble for steering their clients away from those properties. Like that's kind of hard to prove though. Like if I'm looking at 20 properties to send to my buyer, I mean, I could have 10 different reasons why I didn't send them these five listings. And none of those could be the co-op. It could just be like, oh, this just looked like it was too outdated for my client. Whatever. So it is interesting that it went all the way through to the point where now we have to change the process. But you know what? Innovation always happens. Like I'm not worried about it. I welcome change and innovation. Because the old system isn't always great. Like at least on the agent side. Like yeah, we probably get paid too much most of the time.
Oh, man, you are such an honest person, dude. Like, you are the type of guy I would have a beer with. You are so honest. So would you think, like, net-net, is this ruling that happened, do you think it's a good or a bad thing?
I think it's bad for buyers. I don't think buyers are going to really enjoy, especially now, like, we have high interest rates. We have a system where you've been told, you know, 3.5% down or 10% down plus closing costs, and that's it. That'll get you into a house. And now we're saying, like, that amount plus paying your agent or negotiating, you know, for your agent's commission. That's just a change that will be painful in the short term. There's going to be a ton of buyers who go it alone, and they might get burned on that side of going into a contract or going into a real estate situation where they've never bought or sold. There will be new services and companies that come forward, and they'll try to fill that gap. You know, they'll just say, like, hey, look, here's a, you know, $500 tutorial on everything you need to do, or flat fee buyer's agents or something like that. Like, there's always things that fill the gap there between those two things. But at the end of the day, you know, the sellers will probably get inundated with uneducated buyers because they're trying to go it alone. And I think that there will probably be a world where the seller's just like, it's worth 3% to that buyer's agent, or 2% or one, whatever. It's worth it out of my chunk so that this just gets done. And, like, we have professionals involved. Yeah. Like, I think that on the other hand, I think that, like, when the last, you know, boomer dies, like, real estate agents' jobs will totally change. Like, there probably won't be people to go hold their hand through the process, where the, you know, people who are younger like you can go on the internet and figure out, like, 90% of the process and get consulted the rest of the way through for a flat fee or something like that. Whereas there's a market for A to Z, you know, customer service. And usually that's with older folks. I have young professionals that I help out. They just don't have the time to deal with anything. Like, trying to get them to just sign the contract, like, to have time enough for that. So somebody like that who is just like, I do not have time to deal with any of this. Like, you take care of all of it. And they're like, you know, 28 and they're busy, you know? So there's going to be change. I can't say how much it'll change. It probably needs to change on a lot of levels, and some of the change just will snap back to the way it was. And some of it, companies will come in and fill in the gaps and say, we'll do this for a flat fee, or, you know, you'll get a, you'll have like an Instagram course or something that you go there. I don't know.
Oh man. I think it's like, to me, it's the biggest financial decision that most people make. If there's ever a time to not go cheap, it seems like that's the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that sentiment. Like I do this multiple times per month. You know, somebody, your average person probably moves every 8 years, something like that, or buys and sells a house every 8 years. And so, you know, some people just do it once. You know, they'll buy or sell once. And so if you're hiring somebody who does it, you know, 100 times more than you, then it should be worth, you know, the money that you're paying. Now, is the amount that you're paying probably too high and based on a percentage of a sales price? Probably. Like, that's probably too high, but it's definitely worth it versus, you know, like, hey, here's $1,000. Now, sell my $1 million house. Like, that's also scary, right?
Oh my God. No, that's terrifying, man. Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on, bro. You are so smart, and I'm glad I got to talk to one of the good landlords out there. I think there's like five and you're one of them. So I was also talking to you. You want to let people know where they could find you on the internet?
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on Instagram at Young Anson or on YouTube, Anson Young.
That's it, man. Once again, thank you so much, Anson. You have a good day.
Hey, you too. Thanks, Anson.